From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In recent growing seasons, the new normal of a changing climate has sometimes been making me feel like my northeastern garden has relocated farther to the south. So maybe that's part of what caught my attention when I saw news of a new book called Secrets of Southern Gardening, Pro Tips for Success, that was just published by today's guest, horticulturist, nurseryman, and garden designer, Jenks Farmer. He's here to share some of those tips on smarter planting, especially of trees, and watering how-tos and more, many of them applicable for wherever you garden. So more in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Augustus Jenkins Farmer, a.k.a. Jenks Farmer, is a longtime horticulturist and garden designer and the former director of Riverbanks Botanical Garden in South Carolina and author of several garden books, including most recently Secrets of Southern Gardening. True to his surname, he is also a farmer specializing in growing and selling crinum lilies and a few other goodies from his organically managed 18th century South Carolina farm. I'm so glad to welcome him back to the show today. Hi, Jenks. How are you?
Hey, Margaret. I'm great. It's hot down here.
Well, yeah, I'm in my southern garden, too, as I said.
Right.
It's not hot here at the moment, but there were many times this summer that I thought, oh, my goodness, what the heck's going on? And it's funny because chapter one of your book, I think, is called Our Crazy Southern Climate. And I thought, yeah, our crazy climate everywhere, huh? But yes. So before we talk about your crazy southern climate, I'll just say we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. But yeah, your crazy southern climate, how is it nuts? What's crazy about it?
Well, even in normal times before things got really crazy, I say we have six seasons because we have a really long fall. So for us, I think it's very confusing when people move down here from the north and they expect fall to happen like in September and October. We don't even get a frost until about Thanksgiving. So that gives us basically two growing seasons in the summer. We can start in April planting, you know, things that people plant for squash and zinnias and all the easy annuals. But those kind of things peter out. So for August, September, and October, we have a whole new summer. So we have crinum lilies are coming into flower in the vegetable garden, okra, and you know, we harvested like 9 pounds of eggplant yesterday.
Oh my.
So we have that sort of two separate summer seasons.
Yeah.
And then for us, winter can be just outrageously variable. So we can go from 70 degrees on New Year's Day to 13 degrees that night. And it's always been that way in our climate. And that's very hard on plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the key for people who are moving here, or even people who are thinking about visiting, is remembering how variable it is and that we can have absolutely spectacular, beautiful days in February and again in September. But then, like, you know, tomorrow it's going to be 95.
Mm. Where are you exactly located? What's the name of the...
It's near Augusta, Georgia. So
near Augusta,
we'll know exactly where that is.
Okay.
But it's a little town called Beach Island. There is no beach and there is no island here. But we're in South, right in South Carolina, along the Savannah River, not too far up from Savannah.
Okay. So speaking of funny names, I like that you have a beach island with no beach and no island. Reading as a northern gardener in the new book, I love noticing some of the regional differences, you know, not just in plant choices or the timing of when you do what and so forth and how you do things, but also the common names that we use in different regions and other vocabulary choices, like a wonderful native, more to southern, not where I am, but more southerly, the Chionanthus virginicus that I can grow too, though. I call it the fringe tree and you call it
Granddaddy Graybeard.
Granddaddy Graybeard. I love it. I love it. It's like I never heard that. It was like I was so delighted by these kinds of things. And, you know, it's just one of the many southeastern natives that's hardy up north too, and, you know, has been marketed as a garden plant, like oxydendrum, you know, the sourwood and bottlebrush buckeye, Escus parviflora. I mean, a couple of species of Father Gila, you know, we think of them as southeastern natives, but they're hardy up here and they're popular garden plants in a lot of the country. And maybe they were native up here too before the last glaciers, right? Who knows?
Right. Oh, yeah. You know, that's it's such a crazy question with nativity, because things move and they have. And then a lot of times what we think of as native was only based on what European travelers wrote about when they got here and what they saw. So maybe they didn't see the Chionanthus that was growing on the shore of New Jersey.
Yeah. Or now they'd use the fossil records, of course, as well. So there are some more, you know, compared to back then. But yeah, it's really interesting that we have a lot of overlap in plants, even though, you know, we're far apart and our climates are supposedly so different. So it's fall planting time in a lot of places. And there's this section in the book about planting, especially trees and other woody things, I think. And a lot of your advice, and after all, I mean, the book is called Secrets of Southern Gardening, Pro Tips for Success. And there were so many pro tips, so many things that reminded me of when I've violated them, how it went wrong, you know, and the things that we really need to remember. And I just loved your way of explaining the why and the how of, you know, you buy a tree in a nursery pot or a bowl and burlapped and so forth, and figuring out like what level it should, how deep it should go, and how to get it ready to be in the hole in the ground that you're going to make for it, and how to aftercare it, you know, water it. I just thought, for instance, that was one of the really great lessons. And it might seem basic to people, but I think a lot of people just take it out of the pot and put it in a hole the same level it was at in the nursery pot. And that's not always a good idea, is it?
No, you know, so I'm a nurseryman and I grow mostly in the ground, but I have some things in containers. And the goal in the nursery is to have a potting media that makes that plant look great in the nursery, right? Because growing in a pot with constant irrigation, with wind, is a whole different thing from growing in the ground. So my potting media, and not just me, but any nursery's potting media, is about our success so that we can sell that plant. Mm-hmm. It's not about success in transplanting, right? And a lot of big nurseries, especially, you know, are looking for ways to save money. So they're incorporating waste materials into their potting mix. A lot of bark gets mixed in now. Down here, peanut shells gets mixed in. Those things are fine for the nursery, but they're super dry. So anytime that I'm planting, I do landscape planting, you know, design work.
And, sure.
If I can, I saturate those plants, even the big ones. I'll take on a job, 5 or 6 baby pools, and fill those pools up and try to let those plants soak overnight, because it can be so difficult to get that potting mix wet. Then the next thing I do is, when I take that out, I beat off a lot of that potting mix and take it away. I want, especially for woody plants, I almost bare root them and put them back in the ground. Now, I'll mix in some of that bark. I'm not saying it's terrible stuff, but for root contact with your soil, the best thing to do is to get rid of a bunch of that.
Right. And the other thing is the depth. There was one picture in the book, you know, showing, I think, a tree that had just gotten planted or had just come out of its nursery pot. And I mean, it was so at the wrong level. And yes, you point out in the book, you couldn't see the root flare, where the trunk
right.
meets the uppermost roots, and they sort of do flare gradually outward to begin that, the root zone, and it was like bark was buried, and that's often the case. You know, it's
that,
not ideal.
That particular tree, that was one I bought for myself, not for a client, and I splurged on this little 2 gallon tree from a very good connoisseur's nursery. But when I got home, I realized that it was 2 inches too deep.
Yes.
And so 2 inches of that soil on the top of that pot, I had to cut it off with a handsaw. And this is not uncommon. Again, I'm saying this is from a good nursery, right? A lot of our plants come from box stores and nurseries that are really big, and they're even worse. So that top layer can inhibit the plant growth first, because the bark that's inside that layer is subject to rot and therefore subject to lots of pests.
Yes, it can stay all like moist and get, you know, like rot almost, like,
yeah,
funky, right?
Right, fungus. And
and
then on a larger scale, because we do some big tree planting, right, with tree spades where we're planting like 10-inch trees. Those trees often have the same thing, the same problem, but that soil on a bigger tree will actually inhibit the growth of that trunk below ground. So you end up with this sort of narrow trunk that's below ground, this little spot that's restricted, and then you slowly get a bigger trunk growing bigger girth above ground, but you always have that weak spot. So for
yes.
us, a hurricane, that's terrible, because that tree's got a built-in place to snap.
Right, and even without a hurricane,
right,
improper depth, especially too deep, can be a killer. It sort of almost suffocates the plant, doesn't it? Can't it potentially? I mean,
definitely. I just see this over and over, and that's one reason I wrote this book was from the perspective that a homeowner who may not be planting their 30-gallon plants, they might
right.
be hiring a landscaper to do it, but they need to know this. So when they're out there watching their landscaper work, they're making sure it's done right, because that's ultimately, it's your responsibility. If you're hiring somebody to do it, you know, it's like, you know, with me hiring a doctor, I also pay attention to what and read up about the issues, so that I have some idea that what that doctor is saying is making sense. Does that
yeah. Yeah.
Follow.
Yeah. And then the other thing that you point out in the book, which I never see anybody except longtime horticulturists with old style training do, like us. but it is so essential. You know, I see people make that hole, get the plant in the hole, pack it with the soil, get it all, tamped down, and then try to water it. And it's
right.
Like, what?
And that's the best case, that they try to water it. A lot of times you'll see a company say, oh, we're going to turn on the irrigation.
Well, that's hopeless to irrigate like big, extensive new plantings and stuff like that. It's not going to do the job in that, for all those transplants, for sure.
So we were planting this morning some 30-gallon magnolias, and I took a little video of us mudding it in. I don't know if you can embed a video.
Yeah, I can. And you say, it was so funny because you in the book, you explain this technique, mudding it in, which I call puddling it in. And I don't know who told me to call it that a million years ago or whatever, but it was the same technique. And I thought, I'm the only person I know, when I'm with people where I live, and stuff's being planted, I'm the only person I know who does this. And
man, I'll tell you, this is something I struggle with my guys and all the time. When we're planting on a job, I want that hose running all day long.
Yeah.
Because every plant, when we're just moving it, you know, we do that mudding in where we're like jamming the hose down in the ground.
Before we've, again, totally fully backfilled and tamped and made everything look perfect, right? Like we're doing
exactly.
It. So tell us just, I should backtrack and said, what is mudding in or puddling
okay,
in?
Okay, so like you know, you dig your hole, you put your plant in there that you've knocked a lot of root soil off of.
Yeah.
And you have your water running the whole time that you're backfilling.
Yep.
And the reason for that is that no matter what you do, there are always going to be air pockets that you can't see and can't tamp in.
Yep.
But that water running creates like little mudslides and it fills in all those spots.
Yeah. And so you muddle, I puddle.
And see, but, I love doing that. And I've loved doing that since I was a kid. I remember every time I do it, I remember when I was a kid, like punching that hose down in the ground and making little tunnels.
Yeah. Because if these plants only have one chance to get a good start in our soil, don't they? I mean, do you know what I mean? It's really, this is not a time to skimp or to stress them out further. It's enough
absolutely,
already.
Absolutely.
Transplanting is enough, even if it's done correctly, it's a stressor. So we want to give them the best possible.
Absolutely. And I, you know, people, my design clients will ask me sometimes, do you guarantee your plants? I'm like, no, these plants are like puppies. I'm going to plant them right. And if they're planted right, they're going to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
No, and I have no doubt of that. It's aftercare is important, but that first 20 minutes is critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of also related to giving things a good start is, and again, that you cover in the book, is deciding where they can be placed sort of in the microclimates or the different areas of one's landscape, you know, one's garden, one's home garden.
Right.
And you make the important point that I think a lot of us don't think about. We all as gardeners, I think about, is it a sun plant or a shade plant? But we don't think about soil moisture as much, right? And so we're grouping for light a lot of times, but that's not the whole story, is it?
No, and especially with us, because we can go from red, heavy clay to like literally 100 feet away can be like white sand.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, you know, those are totally different plants. It require, I mean, totally different soils and drainages, and different plants thrive in those different soils.
Yeah.
You know, when you mentioned microclimates, you're probably going to think this is funny, but I was looking at a place the other day and it was like a north facing wall and it's a little heavy clay. And so it's shady all the time. It doesn't get any winter sun. And I thought, maybe I can plant some anemones there. Because for me, that's a cold microclimate that I might be able to make some anemones and some more northern plants thrive.
Right. That wouldn't just bake and sulk because of the heat.
Yeah, but I think generally when people think of microclimates, they think of how can I fit in?
Warmer, right,
warmer
place, right. Well, that's a good point also, because like I remember a million years ago when I wanted to have this a magnolia, and when I was first making the garden, I wanted to have a magnolia, an early blooming magnolia, but a different one. And I asked the best local nurseryman, and he said, well, here's one that he named, you know, he pointed one out to me. He said, this one will never get, the flowers will never get ruined by a late frost if you plant it like the kind of spot you're just talking about, more in like
right.
The east or the northern side of your house, like somewhere where it's not going to be toasted all the time, you know,
right.
Where it's going to wake up later. Not
yeah.
Wake up early. So, and he was right. I've had the thing 30 years or something. And, you know, Ballerina, it's called, one of those Lebner or Loebner. I don't know how you pronounce them, man's name,
Right,
yeah,
right.
who developed them, the series. And he was absolutely right. Is looking for the microclimate that would delay its awakening, those buds becoming vulnerable.
Right.
Yeah.
And I just I see there's an example of when you're a much better gardener than I am, because
Oh, stop.
I've just accepted that those magnolias always have a brown period, and I've taught myself that it might as well call it pretty.
Oh, they are beautiful creatures, though, aren't they?
Yeah.
I was really drawn that whole chapter that involves watering it in the book is called Mindful and Efficient Watering. I loved it. It sounded very Buddhist, because, frankly, growing up as a Northeastern gardener, we used to have like that old sort of proverbial, inch of rain a week kind of thing. It used to be more regular and more. It's not the case anymore. So I'm not as expert at watering. And You had one tip about a 5 gallon bucket with a hole in it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's a real redneck way to do it, but
I loved it. I loved it. It's
it
great.
works. We do that a lot. You can buy these tree bags that are basically a big water balloon with a slow drip on them. But those things are super expensive. And we just take a 5 gallon bucket and put a nail hole in the bottom and fill it up, once or twice a week and let it slowly drip. And then the other tip, I guess this is what makes it really pro, is that we put a red spray paint mark on all those buckets, because you sure as hell don't want to pick up that bucket and fill it up with water to carry it to water something and have it squirting water out on your sock the whole way.
But so you're placing this bucket with this little hole in it. You're placing it near specimens that need that extra help during tough times or whatever. So they're going to get this extra water. I
Right.
forget what those vessels are called, those clay vessels. What are those? Oh, I forget what they're called. Anyway, there are
Right.
traditional vessels like that are fancy that do this. Olla, is that the word? Olla, oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, I
I've
can't
read
remember.
that word, but I've never
Yeah.
said it.
No, me neither. And but exactly. So the point being, however we do it, we have to be attentive, mindful, as you say, about watering, and especially when
Yeah.
plants are getting acclimated.
All different plants need different needs. And that's a technique that we use mainly on new plants. But in a drought summer, and we've been really lucky for the past 3 or 4 years, we've had very wet summers. September, October is always very dry. There are times that there are certain plants that just need that little bit of water to thrive.
Right. So in the last 3, 4 minutes or something, we have something else in common, besides muddling and puddling. We both have discovered the beauty of the nighttime activity in the garden, the night shift, as I call it. And you actually hosted this year a moth event that I think you called a moth ball. Ha ha ha. Very funny. So
We
yes.
did. We called it the mothball, and I did this graphic for it that my young friend said nobody's going to come to that because it looks like it's a techno dance. But we had ended up having 70 people. We had three entomologists from three different universities who set up screens, and they, while people grabbed a drink and some hors d'oeuvres and wandered around from screen to screen. So they got three different interpretations of the night insects that were attracted to these screens. I guess I should have said each screen had a different kind of light on it, so it
Yeah.
attracted different insects.
Huh.
Was primarily about moths, but the night shift, as you call it, was all there.
Yeah, and usually the closing chapter in the book is about that, which is wonderful because so many of us gardeners, we know our place so well, but not after dark.
Right. And I realized in writing this, not that many people really want to garden after dark.
Right.
But But nonetheless, it's really important that we understand it, because the world in the garden after dark is absolutely as active.
Oh,
and
yes.
Really, maybe even more important. Moths are really basically more important pollinators, I think, than butterflies.
Yes.
So, and then all the decomposers come out.
Yes. You know,
it's critical that we understand that, so that we treat, especially with light. Light can be a problem. But also with other things that we're doing, you know, we have to be aware of herbicide and fertilizer damage, and even excessive raking and cleaning can take away the places that those larvae need, the moth caterpillars need to.
Sure.
Pupate.
Yeah. No,
so
well,
you actually inspired that whole chapter, Margaret. Thank you so much.
Well, because I'm moth crazy. But the new book, Jinx Farmer, is Secrets of Southern Gardening Pro Tips for Success. And as I said, even as a northern gardener, I found so much information in it, you know, that appealed to me. And so it's wonderful. And we'll have a giveaway of a copy of the book with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. I always enjoy talking to you, and I hope I'll talk to you soon again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Margaret.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.